Indy 101.5 CIOI.
You're listening to a show called Dangerfield on Indy 101.5. I'm Mary, and tonight my guest is award-winning television and radio broadcaster, actor, media producer, and humanitarian George Strombolopoulos. He is the host of the Sunday night radio program, The Strombo Show, on CBC Radio 2, and also the host of Strombo on Apple Music's global radio station, Apple Music Hits. This show is heard in over 165 countries worldwide. Over the course of his career, George has interviewed a who's who of entertainment icons, sports stars, world leaders, and respected thinkers. So welcome to the show, George.
Hi there. You forgot one thing. Your friend.
What?
Your friend.
Oh, yes. You know, my friend. I've known you for what, like, I think like 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years. It's nice to be with you on the show. Thank you so much.
It's awesome. So let's, you know what, let's start off the show. When I think of you, I think of The Clash. And so maybe we'll start off the show with a song from The Clash called Death or Glory off their album, London Calling. That was Death or Glory by The Clash, off their album London Calling. And my guest tonight on Dangerfield is George Strombolopoulos. So, George, it's so great to have you here tonight. And so, George, you from 2000 to 2004, you worked at Much Music, and you were the host of many shows such as Much Loud, Much News, at the Punk Show, and the New Music. And in 2001, you actually had the opportunity to interview Joe Strummer. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I remember being younger than 10 when punk rock first started in earnest, in that year zero, 1977, right? We knew, of course, of the Ramones and, you know, Patti Smith before that with Piss Factory and what the Stooges were doing. But when the Ramones, when the Clash and the Pistols, you know, the Damned, Crass later, when these bands all came out, they had a monumental impact on me, partly because, and who knows, I think this is just genetics. You know, sometimes you're just wired to appreciate a sound more than another sound. So the sound of punk rock really worked for me. But I grew up in neighborhoods that were not all white. So the sounds of the Clash really resonated because they were clearly inspired by artists from Jamaica. And there were a lot of Jamaican people in my neighborhood. And I was just so grateful to grow up around this incredible music. And so the Clash landed in my neighborhood, because you didn't have to like punk rock to know that they respected the Jamaican, you know, kings and queens. And so it just kind of stayed with me. And then getting a chance to interview Joe many years later was sort of one of those weird moments. This, you know, black car pulls up outside this church just north of the church courtyard was where I was set to meet him. And he was just outside, and he walks up to me wearing, you know, I think he's wearing a white t-shirt and black jeans and a black jacket. And he's got little salt and pepper hair. And he just says, "How you doing, George? I'm Joe." And I was like, "Holy shit, it's Joe Strummerman." Yes, Joe Strummerman. It was great. You know what? Because what I want out of the people I speak with is for them to show up. Be present. You have to, if you're just there to do the same old, that's totally cool, but I'm just not the person to talk to. I'm not interested in that. And Joe, who's been interviewed a million times, showed up, spoke his mind, was thoughtful, was curious, and was Joe. It made my day. Yes, I will come across that photo of Joe, and I have a couple of them every now and then, and it really lands with me because I remember so clearly so many details about that day.
And how did you prepare for that day? Like, did you have questions that you had always wanted to ask him, and like that was your moment, or was it more kind of like you had a format to follow? Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I used to, when I was first starting, when I was in my 20s in this business, in the early days, you'd have a bunch of questions, especially when you were interviewing sports stars back in my young reporter days. You just had to get to the heart of the matter, right? You had to get to a thing. So, and especially in soundbite worlds when you're doing news stuff. So by the time I got to Much Music, I was able to do a little bit more of a longer form interview. And I realized early on that it wasn't about going in there and asking 500 hard-hitting questions. I didn't think that was effective because I didn't think that was a natural conversation. I wanted to structure a conversation as if I was having a real talk with somebody in my life. So with Joe, I how he felt about the world and how he was feeling about life. But the only thing I really wanted, like I needed to get out of him, was how do you feel now about what you did to the other guys in the band? Mm-hmm. Right? About how do you look back on that? Mm-hmm. And so I structured a conversation around a lot of ideas, but I didn't, I mean, of course I prepared, you research, you do your thing, but interviewing Joe Strummer for a kid like me, at that time, a man like me, a young man like me, I mean, I've been preparing for that interview my whole life.
Right.
Right? Because I feel like Joe was part of my holy trinity, you know, and I was able to get him to speak about the demise of the Clash when Mick was out, but it was really just about seeing how Joe felt about punk rock and what it means to him, and how it's more than just an idea, that it has to be a series of actions. And so I was hoping Joe was going to be like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm just grateful he was.
That's awesome. And so you've interviewed like such a wide range of types of people, from politicians to Nobel Prize winners, and also talk show hosts themselves. So you've interviewed Barbara Walters, Larry King, Oprah Winfrey. Which did interviewing an interviewer, did they flip the tables back on you often, or like what was that kind of banter like?
They certainly tried to. Larry tried to do it almost right away. Larry was always really, really good to me. Like Larry was, you know, Barbara, I loved Oprah. I've interviewed Oprah. She told me this more than anybody's interviewed Oprah. Which was kind of fun. I toured with her, so that was a whole other thing. But
was on her rider?
Never got to see it. But I bet you it was amazing. No, Larry and I, Regis is the same way. What you want is somebody who understands the job, right? Mm-hmm. You know that line that everybody says now on social media, you know, they understood the assignment. Talk show hosts understand the assignment. When you're being interviewed, I remember bumping into Conan O'Brien once at a party, and somebody had introduced me to him and said, "This is George. He hosts a late night talk show in Canada." And Conan just stopped and looked at me and he said, "How's it going?" I said, "It's going all right, man. It's, you know, it's got its ups and downs, whatever." And Conan just looked at me and said, "Man, good for you, because this is, because there's only a handful of people that know what it's like." I think there's like less than 10 people in the English speaking world who hosted a late night talk show for a daily for 10 years or longer. There's a very small group. And so when Larry showed up, Conan, he's like, they get it. They get it that you have to be entertaining, but you also just can't dodge questions. You have to be present. Mm-hmm. And they really, really were. So I loved it. And when they tried to turn the tables, because I'm not, I don't have the ego of it's my show. I've never been that guy. I'm just kind of like, yo, bro, whatever makes the best time, let's have the best time, you know? So I quite enjoyed being around somebody who I knew could carry it,
you know,
should they so choose.
And who's like, who's your mom been the most impressed of you interviewing out of all the famous people you've interviewed?
Carol Burnett.
Really?
Yeah, because my mom, you know, when my old man split and it was just myself, my mother, my sister, it was, you know, it was tough times. Mm-hmm. And Carol Burnett brought a lot of joy into that home. So when things were difficult, there was a lot of laughter because of Carol Burnett and her crew. And so it was more than just a funny show. It was a show that in a way kind of distracted us from what life was currently like or like at that moment. And so when my mother didn't really come down to see the show too often, but she came down to see Carol and she got to meet Carol. And it was really a beautiful moment to see the two of them together, because they're really, really impactful. And yeah, and then there's a moment where the two of them just went off to the corner and just talked. And I'm just watching these two legendary ladies have a conversation. And I was just watching it from a distance. Yeah. That made me really, that really brought a lot of joy to my heart to see the two of them, because Carol meant an enormous amount to my family in a really difficult time.
And who were you the most, would you say, like nervous to interview?
You know, I don't think I've ever really been nervous to interview anybody, but I was certainly, you know, the first time I got to interview Eugene Levy, I was very conscious of what that was, because, you know, for like my mother and Carol, SCTV was that to me. And Eugene and Martin, like, these were our guys, right? Yeah. And so I kind of, being around Eugene was really, really impactful, because I think he's obviously one of the greatest that we've ever been able to be producing as a culture. So that I wasn't nervous, but I was certainly aware of it in that moment that this was Eugene Levy.
And so you have this incredible series called House of Strombo, where you had live musicians in your house. And I was fortunate to go to a couple of them. I saw Steve Earle there. I saw Dino Jr. I think Mac DeMarco. Like building your own home and kind of surrounding yourself with the things that you love. Like, what would you say, like, in your house or that you have that kind of like a music memento that means the most to you?
I have a pizza box that, against me, Laura Jane Grace wrote out her set list on.
Hey.
And I still have, it's actually the back of a pizza. I also have a glass of wine that, I mean, there was more than just wine in it, if you know what I mean. There was a thing going on. It was more than one delivery mechanism for the hallucinogens that Lee Scratch Perry drank out of when he was in my home. So, yeah. So, and I remember showing Lee Scratch Perry an Ableton push. So I had to push through and watching Lee Scratch Perry upstairs in my house, making a beat, practicing on this instrument, sipping a glass of wine, and he was high out of his mind. He was super high. And he was in his 80s and he was high as hell. Mm. So I still have that glass of wine in my
house. Wild. Yeah. And what was, like, when you were in high school, like, what was your room decorated like?
It was posters everywhere.
Yeah.
My room was floor to ceiling, wall to wall, pictures that I would rip out of magazines, and it was all music.
Yeah.
There were a couple of non-music things. There's some movie posters. I was a movie theater usher. Mm-hmm. So I was the person who on Thursday nights would change the marquee inside and outside. And I would also swap out the posters.
Right.
So I just had thousands of movie posters. So I had a lot of movie posters on my wall and a lot of music pictures, but it was mostly metal and punk were on my wall for sure.
And do you have any of those photos still?
No, I don't. I mean, there was I don't know if you remember this, but when we were really young, there was a thing called the Satanic Panic, mm-hmm. when everybody was terrified of Satanism.
Yes.
How fucking stupid are people, by the way? How stupid are people? Satan's going to get... So anyway, my mom, who's a Christian, was caught up in the Satanic Panic era.
Right.
And so there was a cat and mouse game of, I would put up posters and my mother would rip them all down.
Yeah.
And throw them out. So no, I don't have anything from that era because my mom destroyed all of it. And you know what? Listen, my mom and I have such a sweet, great relationship that I don't really mind. It became a fun little game. But yeah, my mom is hyper Christian. So she could not contend with the stuff I was listening to and the images on my walls. So all that stuff's gone.
And so you mentioned, you worked in movie theaters and now you've gotten into making movies yourself.
That's correct. Yep.
Is there a soundtrack that you love the most out of a movie, would you say?
You know, for mood and sentimental reasons, I listen to a lot of John Carpenter. So I listen to a lot of John Carpenter, in large part because he's made some of the great scary films of our time. He made some of the impactful scary films, not just in terms of quality, but in terms of what they did for the rest of the game. And he scored his own music. He scored his own films with his family too sometimes. So I listen to a lot of John Carpenter, and quite regularly in this house, I'll just come in and I'll ask Siri to play John Carpenter. And so John Carpenter's playing all the time throughout this home. But I love scores. So I love, you know, the Bernard Herrmann stuff, of course. I think the score to The Social Network, Trent and Atticus's score, is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. I think the Sicario score is incredible. And so I like that stuff. But I'm, like I said, it's John Carpenter.
Right.
It's John Carpenter and Wes Craven movies are the ones that I listen to a lot.
Cool. So what's your process when you're making movies now with, like, aligning the music to the stuff that you're making?
It's actually really difficult for me because the secret to make, as I understand it, the secret to editing a good film is to not edit to a temp track. A lot of people edit to a temp track, but they say that the film the real G's edit without a temp track, right? But because I think musically, I when I write or direct or produce either stuff that I'm directing or helping somebody else direct, everything in my life that I conduct interviews and you've known me a long time, our relationships with friends, it's musical to me. So it's a challenge for me to not edit to music. So what I've done is the process is I go over there. So just, I don't know, 18 feet from where you and I are, or where I'm sitting speaking with you now, I have my music workstation, and I'll go and I'll write the score for it. Yeah, and I'll record segments. So if we're editing a scene, I don't want to put it to a temp track, but it's like, I know what I want it to sound like. So I'll go and I'll score it myself, then bring it over. Mm-hmm. We'll import it into session. And so then we'll start to maneuver the edit around that.
Well, that's cool.
So I write listening to music for sure. A lot of the time, I listen to a lot of Grateful Dead. I don't know how that happened in my life. I used to not like that band at all.
Yeah.
Like, and now I do, but I will sit there and I will honestly go and I will score that. I think, so what I do is I listen to scores more than soundtracks, mm-hmm. right? Like, I love the Judgment Night soundtrack. I think that's the biggest soundtrack of my life. I respect the soundtrack, of course, but a score to me is a different thing. Like, I think when people think about Hollywood and they name all the greats, they don't name nearly enough John Williams you know, and that most of when people think about Hollywood, what they're really thinking about is John Williams and Hans Zimmer, you know?
Right.
So these scores to me are really impactful. And so I like to write to them and listen to them. Mm. And they're always fresh. They're fresh. You know, I played classical piano as a kid. So scores to me are, you know, John Williams is Beethoven in some, well, he's more Bach, but I love that. But again, when I'm actually making the film, I'm going out there and I'm scoring it on the fly. And I'll work, I'm a piano player, but I'll play a synthesizer and I'll get a couple sounds. And then I'll either record it into my phone or put it right into a USB stick, boom, right into the system. And now I have what I think it's going to be.
That's cool. So for those just joining, you're listening to Dangerfield on Indie 101.5. And my guest tonight is George Strombolopoulos. So George, you went to school for, you went to Humber for radio, and then you had a brief stint at West. Then you came back, you worked at The Edge. And then when you got your own show, like what, when you had the autonomy to kind of create your own radio show, what was the thing that you had always wanted to do that you were able to do?
You know, when I got into radio, the reasons I got into radio, I got into an industry that didn't exist, mm-hmm. right? I got into radio because of a passion for music. And then you find out very quickly that radio is not about music, mm-hmm. that the industry is not about music. The industry is about commercials. Yeah. And so what you're hoping to do is find a place where you can work with a program director or music director who will kind of let you be passionate about music. And you know, and this is the thing that most people in radio don't realize, is they are windows. They are short windows. They don't last long. So I got into radio because I just wanted to be overnight playing music for people. That's it. Then I realized you're playing the same six bands over and over and over again. And I was happy to do it because when I got into it, the music was amazing. There were great bands on the radio, right? And then, you know, the industry, you know, top 40. I've never really worked top 40, but top 40 became top 20, became top six, and now it's like the top five. And it's just over and over and over and over again. So when I was offered an opportunity to do the Strombo show as a music show, my deal was simple. I pick every song or I don't do it. Mm-hmm. Or I don't do it. And I designed a show not to get a big audience. I didn't care about, our whole slogan was every child left behind but one. I didn't want to make that show for the masses. The one I do for Apple is a different kind of show and I love the show and it's a little bit more designed for more people. Mm-hmm. But I did that Strombo show for a long, long, long time, not designed for everybody, but designed for music. It's designed for everybody, but not everybody would like it because not everybody loves music. And that's the fact. Most people like music, yeah. And most people like what they like. There are not nearly as many explorers out there in music as we are. And I think it's because we come from an era, a very brief window, which is the hangover, the party and the hangover of AOR radio. That's what's informed a whole bunch of us. Because radio was boring before and radio is boring now, right? There was just a brief window.
Yeah.
And there are, of course, like what you're doing and what I'm lucky enough to do, that's why I went to Apple, because they let me do this thing where there are bright spots. But the industry as a whole is super basic. But for a brief window, mm-hmm. when we're making our artistic choices.
Yeah.
Radio was incredible.
It was just the greatest time.
Greatest time ever.
Like, I remember taping, you know, setting up my ghetto blaster and taping off of it, yeah. and then making mixtapes off it. Yeah. And yeah.
It is
calling in, like, requesting music.
It is.
That's how I actually got to see Jeff Buckley, George. Is
really?
I was driving home. I was like 16 and I was driving home and he was on The Edge. Or it was either The Edge or Q107, I can't remember. And then I got home and then he was on The Wedge as well. Like there was like both of them that day. So he was on The Wedge first and then I think I heard him on the radio. And I called up the radio station when people would answer the phone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, who's the guy, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, I really like him. Like, what's the deal? And like, just even the concept of that now. And then they were like, oh, he's playing tonight at Trinity St. Paul. And so I went down there by myself and you had to be 19 to get in. I was 16. Yeah. And then I went in and I just snuck my way up to the front pew center. And I sat in Trinity St. Paul and like, just watched it. And like those kind of little increments of magic.
You know, when I worked at The Edge, we, our studio was a trailer in a park of a band Dundas, right?
Yeah.
And we'd interview all these big bands, but kids would walk by all the time to check out who we were speaking to. And we gave them concert tickets all the time. They would call it celebrities who were in town shooting movies would hear about a band in town from our station and they would come in and get tickets from us. And you're right. Like that doesn't exist the same way anymore. Mm-hmm. Every generation has the thing that they hold on to that was the best. Right. Yeah. And every subsequent generation has their amazing thing, but there is no denying that if you're a Gen Xer in a big city, but specifically what we were lucky to have in Toronto, there's no denying that we had the golden era because we had Q107 and CFNY.
Yeah.
Those two radio stations are why I got into this business. Mm-hmm. They are the reason I got into this business because they were unbelievable.
Yeah.
They were so much of us. They were ours, right?
Yeah.
That's not the same anymore.
Yeah, I agree. And so do you ever listen to, like, I don't know if you've seen that thing online where you can like, you can, it's like the globe and you can kind of tap into like different international,
yep.
like,
yep.
So do you listen to like radio stations in other parts yep. of the world?
All the time, yeah. all the time. Yeah, I always do. I always do. But what I'm looking for now is, so what I've realized though over time is that it's only the indie stations that have what I like.
Right.
Right. That's the truth. So I, you know, of course I listen to the station I'm on because Apple Music is so varied.
Right.
What I like about it, and we don't have commercials, right? So it's there's a ton of, you know, like Huey Lewis has a show. Like, how cool is that? You know, like I listen to Huey Lewis.
Is it called The News?
No, I wish it was. Yeah, no. He does this 80s show and then Mark Hoppus has a show. So I listen to what we do on Apple Music. And then I listen to some college stations, one in particular in LA. And then I kind of just look around. I love listening to I love listening to music from Mali. I love listening to Tuareg music. So, you know, bands like Tanarawin. Well, I like a lot of people are, well, a lot of people in my generation were heavily influenced by the Delta blues.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that has that kind of authentic, and Tanarawin has a blues thing to them, right? The way they play guitar. So I like that stuff for sure. But again, like I said, most of the stuff is really obscure indie stuff that I try to find.
Well, I remember like LA has so many radio stations. Like I remember I drove across the desert once and went to LA and we had one of those things where you had to connect your audio through the frequency, like the space and the frequency.
Yep.
And so we, you know, driving, everything's fine. We got to LA and there was like no space between all the frequencies. Like it's crazy.
It's great. Yeah. There's so much radio because the city, as you know, is a car city. So people are in their car all the time. Mm-hmm. And so you needed radio. Now radio's changed dramatically here, but I first got to LA in 1989 mm-hmm. and the radio in LA in 1989 was bonkers. It was bonkers because this was the center of rock and roll, right?
Yeah.
And the labels. So you were like, I mean, there was a metal channel, KNAC 105.5, right? KNAC, holy shit. It was so, and then there was pirate radio. Like there was, LA was nuts in radio back. Now, of course, like it's the same, you know, organizations that own every channel in every city. They own this too, most of the city. But California is still a weird state. It's still very, as much as people think they know what it is, it's far more outlaw than people realize. Mm-hmm. And so that where I find the real crazy stuff in LA now is the talk radio. The talk radio here is pretty interesting.
Really?
Yeah, because there's really cool independent hyper left-wing stuff. And of course there's insane right-wing stuff. And so the talk radio is where stuff can really happen. Because there's a real public broadcaster culture here. Mm-hmm. For a certain audience.
Sure.
The NPR culture here is really meaningful.
Yeah.
And in California, I was even able to guest host on NPR here back in the day on the KPCC, which I was so happy to do, mm-hmm. you know, because I listened to that station for so long. But yeah, radio in LA is amazing. It was amazing.
And so when you listen to, like, you're exposed to a lot of global artists, would you say that they're outside of North American artists, would you say that there is like a country that you're most drawn to the artists from? I don't know if it's like currently or a phase that you went through. Like I remember going through a phase of like German music, for example.
Yeah. It depends it depends on the genre, to be honest with you. So like I still like many people who love heavy music.
Yeah.
I get my heavy music from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
you know, there's a Welsh band called Venom Prison. Larissa, the lead singer, I think she's the best vocalist. I think that they are like unbelievable. Like, so Venom Prison, but most of that's one of the very rare ones that I listen to that sing in English, because a lot of it is Swedish or Norwegian or Polish. So I really like that stuff. I love for psych rock. I love Brazilian music. I think the Brazilians have incredible. Also, some sub-Saharan African countries have pretty cool psych rock. There's a really interesting punk scene out of Soweto in South Africa.
So
TC, what are they called? I can't say the name of the band on your show, but TCIYF is the acronym.
Okay.
You know, the blank in your face. A band that I loved from out of there. So yeah, so I listen to a lot of, so I definitely do listen, but like I said, it's very genre specific.
Yeah.
The UK still gives great stuff, but as a whole, but if I want my metal, I'm going to places where it's cold and mean. That's where I want my metal from, mostly. That's definitely where I want my metal from.
So tell me about, so you've got a music therapy scholarship that you've started. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so the Canadian Music Therapy Trust Fund, which is on Bloor Street in Toronto, they provide this really beautiful service of therapy to people. But because music therapy isn't results-based in the way that our culture defines a result, there's no cure for this. A lot of this is palliative. A lot of this is comfort. A lot of this is company. A lot of this is neurological. Politicians and most people don't really like, they can't come out here and say, we gave this much money, we cured this, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't get a lot of love. But I've seen how important music therapy is for people. And you look, we all know the power of music. We know that. We all love it. But there's something different from listening to music that gets us through the night to music as a tool in the hands of a trained therapist. That's a whole other level that it can provide. And it provides comfort to people who are often abandoned or forgotten by society at large, or ignored or diminished. And I that breaks my heart, obviously, but I just don't want to be a party to that, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, what do we need? Well, we need to train more music therapists. Okay, well, how much does it cost? Okay, well, let's do it. So yeah, for many years we did one scholarship. This year we have two scholarships. Cool. So I didn't want to name it after me, but they suggested it had to be named after me for attention, I guess. Yeah. So it's called the George Strombolopoulos Music Therapy Trust Fund Scholarship. And I love it. We just selected the two people who are going to get it this year. And I'm really happy for, because here's what I know, Mary, it's that there's somebody who really needs someone to sit there and play a song for them and to just be there for them. Mm-hmm. And I know that these students who become therapists, they're going to provide a lot of comfort to us. Like, we're all in this together. I know this, we're all in the same storm and we're not all in the same ship thing. That's true, but we're still us. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like it was a place that I could be effective.
Yeah, great.
And it's, so I love it. It brings me, I don't do things for rewards. I really don't. I have no sense of pride in my career. I don't have a sense of accomplishment in my career. I don't see the world that way. I don't care about things that way. It's not, oh, look what I did. I don't care. What I love is when we say, dude, look what we did. I've never wanted to be the biggest singer in the world. I wanted to be in the best band in the world, you know? And I feel like the music therapy scholarship is a chance for me to be in the band. But it's not about me. It's nothing to do with me. You know, I've lived a privileged adult life, and I do whatever I can. And music has been such a big part of it. And I just see watching a therapist work. I've been in the rooms when therapists are working, and it is something special.
So for those just joining, you're listening to Dangerfield on Indie 101.5. And my guest tonight is George Strombolopoulos. I guess my other question is, so when you've had people at your house, artists that are performing, have you ever gotten to kind of request like the songs that you want to hear?
Yeah. So what we say is we know they're going to pick 5 or 6, 7 songs, right, whatever the 5 to 7 songs it's going to be. For those bigger shows. And then we'll just say, hey, man, I really want to hear this song. I'd love it if you picked this song. And they usually, you know, I'll give them 3 songs I want them to play. Mm-hmm. They'll usually pick 2 of them. And I give them 3 knowing they won't pick all 3. But yeah, I just, I love to hear, I do that thing out of my house, because when I was working at the Edge, we would have bands perform in the studio, like in the storefront, and kids just could come and hang out. Right. It was free. And you see it firsthand how impactful it is on a kid's life when they are close to an artist who means a lot to them.
Yeah.
And then the Edge got rid of that. They don't do that. And I went to work at Much Music, and Much Music used to do that too. And Much Music doesn't do that anymore. So one day I was walking down Yonge Street, and I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I was walking down Yonge Street and I passed by where we used to broadcast from the Edge. And it was like a home or a candle shop or something. And I made a right onto Queen Street, and I was walking home, and I walked past Much Music, and they had boarded up their windows and were doing something else in there. They weren't doing this thing anymore. And I remember saying, F you guys, you don't know how hard we worked to create a space where people across Canada could come and feel okay for a minute. And I know that every broadcaster is the public broadcaster, because every broadcaster uses public airwaves. You know, they play songs that are, you know, that are funded by government. You know, everybody in Canada gets these subsidies, like the broadcasters. But it bugged me. I'm like, you guys have to do something for your community.
Right.
You know, because you're taking all of the money anyway. You know, when broadcasters talk about, oh, cable cutting. No, but you own the internet access, bro. Like, you own the access. The same people who own those channels that we're no longer watching still own your access to the internet. So you're still streaming. So I just really fundamentally believe that the public airwaves are in some part public.
Right.
So I just was pissed off at Much Music and at the Edge. So I just said, F it. I'm going to do it at my house. And I remember I was in Ottawa one day, and Ottawa or Montreal, I was in Ottawa. And I was going to fly home.
Oh, that's why you did it. I didn't know that.
That's why I did it. And I was in Ottawa one day, and Jimmy Eat World were going to come over to my house to play a few songs. Right? So I just, in the morning, I'm on the plane before we take off, and I go on my Instagram and I make a story. Hey, if you love Jimmy Eat World and want to see them play, essentially like the old days, right? Send me an email. It was an hour flight? I landed. I had a couple hundred emails, right? And I said, if you can be in this area, wrote a bunch back and said, meet me at this park. So a bunch of people met at this park, and they didn't know why or what it was. And then I walked up to the park, and people were like, what? I said, here,
come on over.
We're gonna walk to my house now. So we just walked. The park was right there by my house. And we just walked. And they all walked in my living room. And people were like, what is going on here? We're in Strombo's living room? Like, yeah. Anyway, here's Jimmy Eat World. They were in the basement. And Jimmy Eat World came up and started playing for people. And I looked at the reaction in people's faces. And I thought, yeah, this is exactly why I did it. And I also thought, Mary, you put skin in the game by letting strangers into your house.
That is true.
It's skin in the game. So now I mean it. So you better bring it, you know?
Right. Well, because music's such a, it's a family too, you know? Like, I remember when I started, remember MySpace, when MySpace came around, I used that this kind of research tool, and I would go to different kind of pockets and try and figure out who the best bands in each city were. Yep. And then when they would come to Toronto, I'd be like, oh, do you guys need a place to stay? And that's how I met half the people I know, because, you know, like-minded people. And I remember, and a cool thing about you too is I remember one of my friends who I met that way, my friend's band Deer Tick. And I remember you shared with me, a song of theirs with you, and you played them on your radio show before anyone had heard of them. And that was super cool. And so thank you for the support that you've always provided up and coming folks. And
I have no, you know, the only discernible skill set I have, which turns out is not good for business, but is good for, which is good for life though.
Right.
Is that genuinely want you to win. And I want to do what I can to help you win. And the And I'm in it for that reason. Like, look, I know that, sure, I want to make money and have a nice house, and there are perks that come with the job for sure. And I like them. They're not the reason I do it, but I know that if you do this right, you're going to get those anyway, if you're lucky, if you do it right. But my reason for being is I can hear music in an emotional way. Like, I feel music in a way that is not particularly, like, I just, you know how you are. You and I are very similar this way. Music hits us on a certain level, right? And I don't want the same three consultants in Canadian radio to control what everybody hears. I play songs that I know most of the audience will tune out for, but it doesn't matter. It's about, you got to hear this band. Mm. You know, you got to be in it. And I love supporting artists for sure. And I love, like, I don't know, like when John Prine played in my living room, right?
Oh my God, my dad, right before I talked to you, my dad was like, are you going to ask him about John Prine playing? He's obsessed with that performance. Tell me about that.
You know, John Prine, first of all, the audience was stacked with Canadian musicians who just were all like worshipers of Prine. But there was a moment where there was one guy in the audience who didn't know who was going to play.
Yeah.
He worshiped John Prine. And his friend invited him, but said to me, hey, he doesn't know. John Prine is like the most important artist in his life. He doesn't know. So I said, cool. So I told everybody else pretty much, do not say who's playing today. Right. So my house has got 100 people. It's my living room area. You've been in my home. It's not that big. No. There's 100 people packed in my living room. Jim Cuddy was there. Sam Cash was there. Menno was there. You know, people were there ready to see this. Tara Lightfoot was there. So I'm like, oh, John Prine. Okay, so this guy doesn't. Nobody loves John Prine. Cool. So I said, hey, bro, why don't you guys just sit here? So I had him sit on the top of the stairs, right, knowing that he'd be behind John, but John was going to play for everybody. But knowing that when John Prine came up the stairs, he was going to walk right by this guy. So this guy still doesn't know what's going to happen. And then I'm just in. I go, hey, everybody, let's welcome John Prine. And the look, because nobody could have imagined John Prine, the legend, was going to come play in my living room. So the look in this guy's face of just, and I was staring at him when I said it. It was just, he was, what? And John Prine walks right by him. And he looks up. And he may even have touched him. I don't know if they brush shoulders. But that, to me, that's what it's about, right? It's about that. And the amount of people who, I get messages every single day. Mm-hmm. About that John Prine performance, every single day about that John Prine performance, because from all over the world.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful that John played there and was so kind, you know. And I don't know if I told you this, but him and his wife Fiona, oh, amazing, said, hey, look, we're playing New Year's Eve. This is December. Said, we're playing New Year's Eve at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. Why don't you come down? And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm doing that.
Yeah.
So I go to Nashville to watch John Prine. It's John and Iris Dement, you know, who doesn't come out and play a lot of these shows. So it was Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats, John Prine, or Iris Dement, and then John Prine. All great artists. And so I'm just watching the show side stage. Mm-hmm. So I've got a chair on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry just watching. I was like, I couldn't believe this. And then Fiona says, hey, just keep an eye near the end. So I'm like, cool, what's going to happen? So we're approaching midnight. And John looks over, there's a handful of us sitting side stage. And John looks over and motions for us all to come on stage. And Fiona's like, let's go on. So we all go on stage and we sing Auld Lang Syne.
No.
With John Prine and Nathaniel Rateliff and Iris Dement to ring in the new year at the Opry. It wasn't the Mother Church, of course, but it was the Opry. And I'm standing there singing, and John looks at me and he's like, George. And I'm just like, my God, I could not, there isn't a universe. When I was 12 listening to John Prine at my uncle's house, there isn't a universe where I would have written this, that this could have happened. But it was a life loving music.
Mm-hmm. That led you there.
Yeah. And they let us share it with everybody. And that to me is why I still do this and still care about this because I get emotional just telling you the story because it doesn't matter what my life or career has become or how lucky I've been. And I've been so lucky, those little moments never don't hit me. Like when the Cult played in my living room, and that's kind of how it all started, by the way. So I wanted the Cult to play in my living room. And well, I had done a thing where when I was in talk show where Tegan and Sarah and City and Color came and did a little set, but it wasn't like a, there was no audience. It was just for the talk show on CBC. Mm-hmm. It was really, really nice. But in my mind, I envisioned, I'd seen this Against Me performance, these early Against Me performances where they had played these bars around the US that were really punk rock. And of course, having grown up going to a lot of those kinds of shows, I was like, man, I want to recreate that. I want Against Me to play, but I want it to feel like that, but I want the Cult to play because I love the Cult. So but I hadn't done anything in the house. So I'm at Coachella one year and I had, you know, managed to snag a pass. So I'm wandering backstage and I go and I see the Cult play. So when the Cult get off stage, Ian Astbury, you know, I knew him from back in the day. He gets off stage. He's like, hey, man. I'm like, hey, bro. Because the Cult are still killer. They're still one of my favorites. And he's like, how you doing? I said, good. I said, bro, you guys need to do this in my living room. And I hadn't done it, right? And he said, we'd love to. We'd love to, right? And I said, cool, man. All right, well, he's like, yeah, next time we're in Toronto. So then months pass and I get a call from their label. And my buddy who works at the label, he says, hey, so anyway, Ian Astbury says they want to play your living room. And I went, we need that. He's like, okay, so we'll do it. We hadn't really done it. We had some bands come, like I said, and play. We hadn't really done it. So I'm like, oh, shit, we better figure this out. So I hired a bigger crew and we started to do all these different shows so that we, because I knew how to do music television with my Much Music experience, but I know that to do this right, everybody has to know how to do it in their heart's core. So I wanted the crew that I was working with, I wanted them to really understand the right way. So we just, I put them through the paces. We did it over and over. Dilly Dally came and played. They were our first, they were great. Jimmy Eat World, like all these bands started to play. And I really wanted the Kills to play the house, but they weren't going to do it. No one was going to do it. I talked to Nurgle from Behemoth. Mm-hmm. I said, Behemoth has got to play a full death metal satanic show in my house. No one, they're like, oh, sure, but no one was going to do it. So here's what happened. The Cult finally comes to town and they do it. And I'm like, yo, dude, you got to play She Saw Sanctuary, which I don't think he wanted to play, but he's like, all right, I'll do it for you. Mm-hmm. So he played it and we invited people from in the record business to come watch it. The people from the Kills team were there in Canada. Wonderful people. Mm. And they're like, yo, this was great. I'm going to see, because they wanted the Kills to do it, but the Kills were not going to do it. But they're like, I'm going to send this to the Kills, essentially, right? This is how it was related to me. And then the Kills did it. So then randomly, months later, I just happened to be in LA, because I'm here. And a guy that I know who started Metal Blade Records, Brian, who's a legend, said, yo, bro, I'm in LA. Do you want to come for dinner tonight? I was like, yeah, for sure. He's like, it's a bunch. So I go, there's like the members of Testament, Armored Saint, Mayhem. It's like a pretty metal dinner, right? And Nurgle from Behemoth is there. And he walks up. He's like, dude, do you remember when you asked me to play your house? And I said, yeah. I said, yes. He said, yeah. He goes, I wasn't going to do it. Because sure, I wanted to do it, but whatever. He said, but I just saw the Cult performance. I love the Cult. We want to do it. And I'm like, cool. So that whole thing started. What? That whole thing started because of my disdain for Much Music's and The Edge's decision to not let fans in. But really, it was because of that conversation between Ian Astbury and I on the grass at Coachella after they got off stage.
And, well, and that stuff is beautifully shot. Like House of Strombone, George's joining me tonight. The footage from all of that is just gorgeous. Like all of those sessions, like I think that like they are more viewed than the band's own videos.
100% in some cases, yes. And you know the secret to that too is Todd McDonald, who was working. So I went to Moog Audio, which is this music store across the street from my house, where I would go there so much that the people who worked with me, if I ever got paid for a job, they'd say, do you want us just to make the check out to Moog? Because they knew I would just go buy instruments. So I was lucky enough, Francis, who ran the place, said to me, hey, you should talk to the guy who works in our rentals, a guy called Todd. Mm-hmm. He's a really good sound guy. He'll help you set it up. Todd came in, and Todd is a genius. at sound. And so the way my home is set up, as you know, is like there's a lot of wood and open ceiling with rafters. So the house was designed to sound good anyway, but Todd was incredible and knew how to work the room. So it looked good, but it sounded good. Yeah. And that was really key.
And what kind of feedback did you get from, because you've had massive scale artists play your home, and what kind of feedback did you get from them? Because I wouldn't think that a lot of them had been that close to fans at like probably in years, right?
Years. Yeah. They loved it. They loved it. They, you know, the rock and roll legends like the Behemoths and the Against Me's, like their career started playing basements. So they it was nice for them to get that full circle moment. But people like Robert Plant, he loved it because he was like sitting on my kitchen table with a whole bunch of people around.
Really?
I had no air conditioning. It was hot as hell. So I think what they really loved, look, you know this, and you'll have to beep this out. We live in a very bullshit filtered art, a world filled with artifice, right? And the real strength of the early Much Music stuff was that, especially the new music, was the artifice is not welcome, right? We're here to talk for real.
Yeah.
And that doesn't exist the same way, even podcast culture, because podcast culture doesn't, and certainly in the interview game, a lot of them are really good, but many of them are just celebrities interviewing celebrities. So there isn't the same institutional burden of you've got to bring it, right? Mm-hmm. And in music, I mean, because music, as you know, the music business is so manicured that it's publicist run and pop star run. So for us, they're like, if you're going to come, like when James Hetfield showed up, like he walked in. I mean, and even just saying that, like when James Hetfield showed up to my home, he got out of the car. He's like, how you doing, man? He's like, how you doing, man? Hetfield, whoa. Mm-hmm. And I love Hetfield. And we sit down and we start talking. He's like, are we doing this? I'm like, hey, where are we going, man? He's like, wow, this is so casual. I'm like, yeah, this is real. It was like the feeling, you know, being so they really liked real talk. And listen, I've done so many interviews in my life. I am equipped to have a real conversation with somebody. So I'm very lucky that the experience met the opportunity with a healthy dose of passion.
Right.
And so the three things really worked. So the bands, I mean, I'm sure some bands were weirded out by it, but the bands generally really, really liked it.
And you took little photos of each band that came by? You've got a wall. Hines,
yeah. So what we would do is every band we would come in, I'd take a picture of them and then I would mark their height on the wall and then, you know, stick their picture right by the height. Yeah, we had everybody in there. I mean, Arcade Fire, Robert Plant, Lee Scratch Perry, Sister Nancy, you know, like really like an amazing range. Elvis Costello, an amazing range.
And I think that when I was at the Steve Earle one, was Gordon Lightfoot there? I think he was.
Gordon Lightfoot just came to watch.
He was like sitting on your stairs.
I remember sitting on my stairs watching.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember looking up and I was like, is that Gordon Lightfoot sitting on your stairs?
And remember that day? Because I think Allman had just passed.
Yes.
And he covered Midnight Rider.
Yes.
And how great that cover was. That was one of our most viewed videos for a long time. Yeah, Gordon Lightfoot just sitting on the – like, that's weird, right?
It was
like
weird. Because I remember I just kind of looked up and I was like, what? But that's what I loved about the shows there is, like, you would be in, like – it was so surreal because, like, you're – you know, and I'm sure for some of the people, they're, like, you know, just as starstruck being in your house, like – you know, that's wild.
Cool. It was so wild. I loved it. I post COVID, I'll do it again.
Yeah.
You know, I'll do it again post COVID for sure. Because it's just something really special about being able to get, you know, well, like when they're really big bands, it's pretty amazing because, you know, when Billy Talent came in, you know, Lights played, when we had Jesse Reyes play early and A Tribe Called Red, just the energy is just incomparable.
And who's your favorite? Do you have any favorite kind of like collaborations of two artists that have merged together that might have like been unexpected? Not necessarily at your house, but just in general, like two artists that you've seen.
You know, we put Serena Ryder together with George Kanyon one year, which I thought was really fun to do. It was really fun. Nice. At Much Music, I was there the day during soundcheck, Lenny Kravitz had a big hit with American Woman.
Yeah.
And at sound check. It was like noon, 1-2 in the afternoon on a Saturday when the Guess Who walked on stage. And I watched the two of them sound check meet for the first time and start to work out how they were going to perform American Woman on the MMVAs. And it was really special to watch.
That's wild. Yeah. I remember seeing Lenny Kravitz at the Gardens and Blind Melon opened.
Oh, so cool.
That was wild.
That's so cool. Yeah. Well, you know what? The other one is 1993 at the CNE, Neil Young played and
with
Soundgarden, Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
And all three of them, and I think even Blues Traveler went on stage all four, and they all sang "Rockin' in the Free World," and that was one of those moments where I was like, "This is pretty dope."
I miss the CNE shows; like, they were fun.
Totally, yeah. Pink Floyd at the CNE is one of the best shows I ever saw in my life.
Well, remember the Planetarium, like Laser Floyd
and Laser Zeppelin, saw them both.
Same here. Well, cool, George. I feel like we're almost coming up on an hour.
You're making great radio. You're making the radio that somebody listening to it now will be inspired to have a hell of a career because of what you're doing. And there's something really important about not just being a defender of the faith, but growing it. And you're doing that. A love of music is real. And as you know, the arts funding is the first thing to get cut and the last thing to be reinstated if it ever is. So to celebrate great artists and to celebrate great songs. Oh my goodness, that's so powerful, and you're doing it. So thank you.
And thank you. You've been a great mentor to me. Like you've given me great advice on doing interviews. And I remember, I think it was like my first show I did, and I didn't have access to the song, and I texted you in a panic, and I was like, George, give me this song, and you were like, give me 5 seconds.
You know what's funny about that? So yeah. when you texted that,
yeah.
I had just launched the Apple show, and I was live. On the air. So I was live on the air when I got your message.
No.
So I'm doing my show and I'm like, give me a few minutes because I'm on the air.
No way.
I knew you were starting your show and I knew you were like, you wouldn't text me if you didn't need something like that because you were on the air. So I'm actually on the air in 165 countries and I get your message. So I throw to a song and I go and I find the song.
Oh my God, you're the best.
I send that to you and then I go back on the air. That's actually how that happened.
Cool. Oh, I love you, George. Well, thanks so much for being a part of this tonight. It's super special. And
I love really, you, Mary. You know that.
It's super fun.
And dude, listen, I'm no mentor to you. You're a colleague. You've given me so much great music and so much great art that you inspire me.
Cool, man. Okay, well, you take care, George. Okay, have a good night. Bye bye.
Bye.
Come.